Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, even counterproductive. I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, actually over the next hour today, is 877-376-45. The second hour today is going to be an archive. I think we're going to replay what we discussed with Kirk yesterday. I've received some information, family-related, that's going to cause me to be occupied otherwise in the second hour of what our normal broadcast time is today. And I may be a bit preoccupied as I try to present the news during the first hour, so please forgive me. I'll have more information forthcoming, perhaps later this week or next week as I learn more. One of the stories that I want to continue with is the one that we were discussing at the end of the first hour yesterday, and that is about this fundamentalist Muslim whose name represents the Lord whom he serves. It is Bel Mukhtar. Bel is the Babylonian name of Baal, which is the Hebrew word for Lord, and Baal is the principal name that Yahweh uses to describe satanically inspired false gods. Baal is used to describe Satan, and Baal is used to describe the false gods that Satan has foisted to fool people into worshiping him as if he were God. And so this Muslim named Bel Mukhtar according to the terrorist experts, followed the well-worn path to jihad, leaving home to fight in Afghanistan when he was just 19 years old. According to interviews on militant websites, he returned to Algeria, the country in which he was born, in the throes of an Islamist insurgency there. You see, it was at a time when GIA, which was is called the Islamist Armed Group of Algeria, was trying to precipitate a civil war in Algeria. That was in the 1990s. And then Bel Mukhtar, in addition to joining the GIA, Algeria's Islamist Armed Group, he became the co-founder of the Salafist Group for Preaching and Combat. Now, you should know that GIA, the Algeria's Islamic Armed Group, was responsible for a score or more of the most devastating terrorist attacks in Europe. All Islamists, all unfortunately blamed on Al-Qaeda, even though Al-Qaeda had absolutely nothing to do with it. This was a wholly independent Islamic terrorist group in terms of their allegiances, at least beyond, of course, the core allegiance to Islam. And many of those in Spain, in France, and elsewhere in Europe were especially deadly. And the Algerian Islamist group not only supplied the jihadists, but also took full credit for their terrorist acts. It was during the period of time that Islam was going from having perhaps a decisive edge in the terrorist behaviors, where they were moving from having, in the 1960s and 70s, having been responsible for about 50% of all terrorist attacks worldwide, to the time that we reached the 80s and 90s, Muslims became responsible for about 80 to 90% of terrorist acts worldwide, with the rest of the world, non-Muslim world, being responsible for a tiny segment of them. And, of course, by the time we reach 2000, and hence, Muslims are now responsible for 99.9% of all terrorist acts. They have an absolute monopoly on the tactic. 2010. And so the Algerian Islamist armed group was at the forefront of this rise. And it is extraordinarily telling that this man who was so active, Bel Mokhtar, in the rise of Algeria's Islamist group, which not only tried to perpetrate Sharia in Algeria, but more importantly tried to terrorize Europe into submission, was the founder of the Salafist group for preaching in combat. I'm not sure I've ever heard a name ascribed to an Islamist terrorist group that is more appropriate. Salafist in Arabic is from the Arabic word Salaf. It means ancestor. And so what a Salafist is a fundamentalist. A Salafist is someone who pays attention to, who follows, who ascribes to the first Muslims, those that accompanied Muhammad. So a Salafist would be one who pays especially close attention to the only source of information regarding the Salaf, which is the Hadith. And as a Salafist, one's going to use the Islamic Hadith, which is oral reports from Muhammad and his companions regarding Muhammad's words and deeds, and the words and deeds of the first Muslims. That they're going to use the Hadith to come to better understand the Quran. They're going to do exactly what I did in Prophet of Doom. They're going to take the Hadith that are presented chronologically, and there's two sources of those. The first is Ishaq's Sirah, which is the biography of Muhammad, which was recorded about, or committed to paper about 125 years after Muhammad's death. It's the oldest extant, quasi-extant, Islamic source. I say quasi-extant because Ibn Ishaq's original has been lost to time, but Hisham did a copy edit of it, removing the most disgusting behavior that was ascribed to Muhammad, and that became known as the Sirah. It's also Ishaq's original can also be reestablished somewhat through the second chronological source, which is Tabari's Tariq, which is the history of Islam's formation. And between the two, we can reestablish most of the Sirah as collected by Ibn Ishaq 125 years after Muhammad's death. And that those two sources, the history of Islam's formation by Tabari, who became the foremost Quran scholar and commentator of his day, and still considered the most brilliant, the most well-respected individual in terms of his analysis of the Quran, his explanation of the Quran, because he used this same technique of putting the Quran into the context of Muhammad's life and reordering it chronologically, which is exactly how I wrote Prophet of Doom. And between the two, what you see is that when the Quran is set into the context of Muhammad's life, and you look at what is known about Muhammad, his words and deeds, and the first Muslims as they were recorded and passed along to us in the exact same manner, from the exact same people from which we get to the Quran itself, that Muhammad was a ruthless terrorist, that he established Islam as a criminal enterprise, that the first acts of Islam are all repulsive and they are violent. In fact, Islam never grows beyond repulsiveness, criminal behavior, and terrorism. They are the hallmarks of the religion, along with sexual perversity, rape, pedophilia, just the total degradation of and abuse of women. And that's where Islam was conceived by Muhammad. That's what Islam remains today. All of this is known by the Salafs. They are individuals who pay attention to what can be known about Muhammad and the first Muslims, and they try to adhere to their behavior so that the first Muslims set the example for them to follow. So they are these terrorists, these ruthless murderers, are all Salafs, fundamentalist Muslims, the best Muslims. And that this group was the Salafist group for preaching and combat. It's actually in Arabic, it would be preaching and jihad. And preaching and jihad go hand in hand. You know, we see that in the Islamic State. The Islamic State is extraordinarily keen on preaching from the Quran and associating the Quran with their established mission, jihad, which is world conquest and the establishment of a caliphate, which is precisely what the Quran orders them to do. It's what Muhammad sought to do, was to conquer the world and have it be wholly and completely subjected to him, subjugated, oppressed, so that everyone in the world would surrender to Muhammad's religion named submission. So this tells us that jihad is the derivative, the consequence of fundamentalist Islamic preaching. You don't have to corrupt the religion. As a matter of fact, so long as you take a literal, accurate, well-sourced view of Islam from the Hadith and the Quran, you will be a jihadist. His group later entered the franchise of Al-Qaeda's North American wing. There was no actual connection between Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda and the AQIM, which was Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, other than there was a period of time when the West was declaring war on Al-Qaeda, where it became a badge of honor for Muslims to be associated with that name. So there are two groups. One, Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula, which was managed out of Yemen, and this Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb that became a name celeb for fundamentalist Islamic groups that were founded without any connections to Al-Qaeda and only used the name. What we find from bin Laden and his archives is a total repudiation of both. So they're only Al-Qaeda in name, not in franchise. We'll return after the break. We learned that Belmokhtar split with the fellow Algerian leader of AQIM, and he built his own Islamic terrorist group. Now, the Pentagon says that Belmokhtar maintained his allegiance to Al-Qaeda. That's nonsense. None of these people have an allegiance to Al-Qaeda. None of them. I mean, literally, none of them. Their allegiance is to Allah, to Muhammad, to the Quran, to the Hadith, to Islam. Period. Nothing more than that. The reason that the Pentagon wants you to believe that Belmokhtar is aligned with Al-Qaeda is that they feel good about going to war against Al-Qaeda because Al-Qaeda was blamed for 9/11. But the fact is, Al-Qaeda doesn't even exist. Yeah, Al-Qaeda had a brief history. It began in the late 1970s when Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Robert Gates decided to use Al-Qaeda along with, and Al-Qaeda was, if it even existed then, it was one person, to use the skill set of Osama bin Laden to augment the manpower capability and ruthlessness of the Taliban in creating a civil war in Afghanistan. And so during that time, Al-Qaeda came to exist as a database, which is what Al-Qaeda means, the base, for jihadists who, like Belmokhtar, who could be recruited from other countries to wield American weapons to attack the Soviet-backed government in Afghanistan. And so there was a period of time that we actually conceived Al-Qaeda. But thereafter, Al-Qaeda grew, of course, during that war, and then there was, you know, a reasonable number of people who were attracted to the jihad in Afghanistan, and when it was over, they still wanted to play jihadist. And so For a period thereafter, there were some Al-Qaeda-related cells. But for the longest time now, for at least 10 years, and perhaps has with absolute certainty over the last 5 years, Al-Qaeda has ceased to exist. They have a figurehead in Pakistan / Afghanistan, probably in Pakistan. And that's really it. There's nothing more to them than that. And what's happened is that the Islamic State, which had no connections at any time to Al-Qaeda, in fact is vehemently opposed by, was by Osama bin Laden, that it now has become the de facto Islamic terrorist group in the world, and that it is drawing the allegiance and attention of Muslims worldwide. So the Islamic State is very real, and Al-Qaeda is simply a mythical boogeyman now. And so that's why the Defense Department wants to ascribe him to Al-Qaeda, even though he was only briefly and no longer associated with an organization that usurped its name for a short period of time. Experts say he is always less of an Islamist ideologue than a gangster jihadist involved in trafficking of arms, smuggling, and contraband. And that's just where ignorance slips into the experts on terrorism. They somehow think that Islam isn't responsible for trafficking of arms, smuggling, contraband, the slave trade, and etc. But what they're missing is what IQ Al-Rasuli so eloquently stated, that Islam was founded as a criminal enterprise. Muhammad founded Islam at Badr. And at Badr, the Quran clearly states that Muhammad sought to rob his neighbors, and that he attacked with full force of arms a civilian enterprise for the express purpose of stealing their property and of killing and kidnapping those who were transporting their property. And the Quran says in that surah, the 8th surah, stealing is lawful and good. And it presents Muhammad as nothing but an organized crime leader. So this idea that he's not an Islamist ideologue because he was involved and has been involved in organized crime, all that does is prove that those who pretend to be experts on Islam know very little about the religion. We'll be back. Security experts. These are the same people that don't think that an Islamist ideologue would engage in the same behavior that Muhammad engaged in. Smuggling, the trafficking of arms, and contraband, all of which Muhammad glorified. Said that if his death was confirmed, it could crimp his group's effectiveness in the short term because of his personal connections in the region. Though the organization will have others well-placed to reestablish its clout. Now, folks, we have killed a lot of jihadists, America has. By America's own count, the number is in the range of 20,000 that we have killed. And yet, by all reports, Islamic terrorism is growing exponentially. So, America's death squads, whether it be through drones, through aerial bombardments, through invasions of countries, has killed many tens of thousands of jihadists at the same time that Islamic jihad has grown almost 100-fold. So if the killing of jihadists, the hunting down and killing of jihadists, is supposed to diminish Islamic jihad, then could you please tell me why Islamic jihad is increasing at a faster rate than is our propensity to kill jihadists? Why is there a direct correlation between the more we kill, the more of them there are? Why is there a direct correlation between the more that we use bullets and bombs the more Islamic terrorism the world endures. Why is it that no one seems to be able to make these connections? Why is it? It's really astounding that no one seems to be able to figure out that by engaging in their game, you know, Islam is a war manifesto. By engaging in their game, by showing cowardice and dropping bombs from on high, particularly using drones to kill civilians. And all of these people are civilians. There's not a single one of them that's part of an official army. They're all civilians. They're not part of a police force. They're not part of a military. They're civilians. That our willingness to drop bombs from on high to kill civilians, which is the very definition of terrorism, to fight terrorism has simply made terrorism more terrorizing, and yet there isn't anyone in the Defense Department or politically or in the media who has been able to draw that connection and say, you know, what we're doing is stupid, counterproductive. We're making a bad situation worse. Yes, Scott?
Isn't that one of the big things that they talked about with 9/11? Oh, they attacked the civilians. They didn't even attack our military. They might be mad at our military, but they attacked civilians. Like, yeah. That's the thing that we use against them, and that's exactly what we do. We use our military to attack their citizens.
Yes, that's exactly what we're doing. I mean, people need to know that when we invaded Afghanistan, there was no military. There wasn't a single time in a moment, not even for a nanosecond in Afghanistan, where we sent in our troops. Did they combat a military? Not a second. When we invaded Iraq, did we face a military? In both cases, 100% of those we bombed and we hunted down and killed were civilians. 100% of the time. And when you bomb civilians, you're committing an act of terrorism. When someone with arms goes off and kills those who are not part of a military, civilians, for the purpose of imposing one's will, whether it be a political or a religious agenda, they are terrorists. That's what we did. And by doing so, we didn't make terrorism better, we made it worse. You can't fight fire with fire. Just can't. You always make things worse when you fight fire with fire. If you engage in the same behavior as those that you despise, you become unworthy, as is your cause. When the CIA, for example, began to torture, it became immoral, unworthy. And you might say, well, they were torturing terrorists. Well, so? So it's not okay for them to torture, but it's okay for us to torture them. Is that our high moral ground? That we're opposed to them torturing, so we're going to torture them. This has not worked. It will not work. I'm not Monday morning quarterbacking this. I explained exactly what the consequence would be of using bullets and bombs to fight Islam before we invaded Afghanistan, before we invaded Iraq, before we declared war on Al-Qaeda. And it's turned out exactly as I predicted. Now, I had an analog to look at. You know, at the time, I did not know Islam that well. I now know it, and now I know how unbelievably stupid our approach has been. But I had an analog, one very fresh in my mind, because I was one of those patriotic, pro-military, political, flag-waving Americans who thought that what we were doing in Vietnam was appropriate, that we ought to support our military and our leaders for this fight that they were taking to those terrible communists, and that we were doing the right thing for the right reason, and come to find out that every aspect of Vietnam was a pile of lies. From the reason that we engaged the Gulf of Tonkin incident, to the nature of this government that we had first deposed and then propped up one of our own liking that turned out to be reprehensible, to the realization that we were simply inspiring an enemy. That with every bullet we fired, every bomb we dropped, we manufactured 100 more enemy than we killed. That was the math of Vietnam. We could have engaged in Vietnam with 10 times the troops, with 100 times the weapons, and rather than fighting for 10 years, we could have fought for 50. And the outcome would have been exactly the same. The casualties would have been higher, the carnage would have been worse, but the outcome would have been the same. And so by the Vietnam analog, I knew that if we engaged this zealous enemy, and I've always viewed socialist secular humanism and therefore communism as a religion. It's a religion of man. It's a doctrine of belief system, believing in the supremacy of man and the collectivization of man. That when you oppose a Machiavellian construct like socialist secular humanism, communism, or you oppose a religious construct that is Machiavellian, where jihad is justified under all circumstances, that any time you fight such an organization with force, with violence, that you're playing into its hands. And so I predicted exactly what we are experiencing. That's what one would expect. And so, more often than not, this article says, when the head of the snake is cut off, a more venomous one grows in its place. This is a North American expert at, a North African expert at West Point's Academy. Yeah. So why bother to cut off the head? You know, this is the thing that we did not ever come to understand about our invasion of Iraq. You know, simplistically, Saddam Hussein was presented as a bad guy, and he was a bad guy. His sons were morally reprehensible, and he was a vicious dictator. Well, all true. But nonetheless, he was, if not the best, certainly one of the best dictators in the Islamic world for his own country. Because at the time, there was relative peace between Sunnis and Shias. Christians actually lived by the many hundreds of thousands in Iraq, and they were not hunted down, killed, their churches burned and tortured. The Yazidis, the Zoroastrians, were able to live in peace as well. By the very fact that there were almost 2 million of them combined at the time that Saddam Hussein was killed, and that now look what's happened. That, yeah, we thought that he was a bad guy, that he was ruthless, and that the world would be better and Iraq would be better if he was gone. But no, we never recognized that in some circumstances, in some environments, in fact, maybe in most circumstances, in most environments, where man has gone amok because of religion, that when you cut off the head of the snake, you very often get a more venomous one. And we got one that is more venomous in Iraq. We got the mullahs in Tehran. And as a result, there's been a dreadful civil war, carnage into the millions of lives. We didn't figure it out. We still don't get it. That by taking Saddam Hussein out, that snake, that we got a vastly more venomous snake. And as a result of our stupidity, of our ignorance, a million or more people have died. This expert on terrorism at West Point says that is certainly a possibility here, and there are no shortage of aspiring jihadists who are eager to pick up his mantle. But the loss of such a central figure may also trigger more competition between criminal gangs, especially over wealth divided from smuggling and arms and militants. You know why they're smuggling arms? Because Qatar provided so many American weapons. Hundreds of millions of dollars worth of American weapons. And what did it do? It not only turned Libya into a terrorist haven, complete anarchy, but it also provided the weapons trade for all of North Africa that brought the hellish conditions of Islam upon Nigeria, Boko Haram, and in the Central African Republic, and throughout Mali, all of which are a direct derivative of the arms trade that took place in Libya, with those same arms having made its way, their way, into Syria. Weapons skill, and we provided them. This goes on to say, but the loss of such a central figure might also trigger more competition between criminal gangs. Islam is a criminal gang. That's just what Islam is. I know that that sounds harsh. I know that doesn't sound compatible with what you've been told. But read the 8th surah of the Quran. Just pick it up and read it. And realize that was the first official act of the Islamic era. That's the first thing Muhammad did when he got to Medina, when he was forced to flee Mecca in shame following the satanic verses. It's Badr. You see, Badr happened because Muhammad was mocked. He was played for a fool. The Meccans knew exactly who he was, that he was pretending to be a messenger of Allah because he craved the very things in life he could not achieve on his own merits, sex, power, and money. And so they offered him sex, power, and money. The Quran details it. The Hadith specifies it. If he would only incorporate their gods and goddesses into his religion. And at the time, his god was Ar-Rahman, the Yemenite stone god, rock god. And so he did. And there's in the Quran, it says Al-Uzza and Alat and are pagan or simply are goddesses, high-flying cranes, goddesses. Intermediaries. And with Al-Uzza and Manat and the others incorporated into the Quran, they said, well, great, Muhammad, you know, we'll give you what you wanted. Make a king for a day. Give you some of our Kaaba receipts, which was a pagan shrine to pagan gods, and here's some of the prettiest girls in town, and then Abu Bakr, who had already sacrificed his six-year-old daughter to this man's perversion. So wait a minute. You said this religion was monotheistic. Now we got four gods. And really five, if you include Allah and Ar-Rahman, along with Al-Uzza and Manat. You got five. And so he had a conniption fee. No, I sacrificed my wealth, my reputation, my six-year-old daughter to you. And so Muhammad says, oh, you know, that was a satanic verse that all of Allah's messengers prophesy on behalf of Satan. And so he was laughed out of town. And just before he left, he had the imaginary journey on the winged ass to Jerusalem to have meetings with long-deceased people in the long ago destroyed temple that he claims still exists after writing his winged ass is the victim of his pedophilic lust. Aisha says, no, he never left his bed that night. And then we have the Pledge of Aqaba, where Muhammad got pagan Muslims, pagan Arabs, I should say, to pledge to wage war against all humankind on behalf of Muhammad. And then he goes to Medina, yesteryear's Yathrib, where he seeks and plots his revenge. And the first act of that, the first act of Islam in the first year of the Islamic era, begins with a criminal raid, a robbery of a civilian enterprise, with murder, with kidnapping, with mutilation, and with the eighth surah of the Quran condoning it all. And so Islam is a criminal enterprise. That's how it was born. That's what it remains. And its behavior will never be any different than was Muhammad. And Muhammad's behavior was amongst the most repulsive in all of human history. So this says that that there will be gang and criminal gangs that will spat over the wealth derived from the smuggling of arms and migrants, which that means they're kidnapping, leading to infighting and the possibility of driving some rival groups like ultra-hardline Islamic State, driving some to the rival groups. So the largest terrorist group now in Libya is already the Islamic State. And it's, this says if Bel Mukhtar is gone, this group, which operates from Mali through Libya, will be less effective and less of a threat. But they will not go away, and most likely they will just throw in their lot with the Islamic State. And there you have it. We made a bad situation worse because America decided to bomb Libya.